Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with my Science Hour. This is for August 10th, 2023, and this week I'm going to pick up where I left off last week. A few quick announcements, but last week I ended talking about my personal experience at Los Alamos. And I was invited there to give a talk on my work. This is back in the 1980s. And it's not a place that they just invite anybody to talk. But anyway, as I ended last week, I was talking about the actually walking into the lecture room that they had set up, and they had cameras set up and everything. And there may have been room for about maybe 15 people in there. Well, about 50 people showed up, so they had to move the venue to a different room, to a bigger room. They did not have time to move the camera equipment, so unfortunately, my talk was not filmed. But I did do a recap of that, and that is done, DVD is available on my webpage. It goes along with the packages. It's on the historically important DVDs, videos of me, and you'll see me as a yet much younger person. And then there are subsequent videos of me that are made throughout the years. One of them is the Astronomy for the 90s video, which was done professionally. I was teaching physics, mathematics, and astronomy at the university level in a state university system. They had a program where they gave money to the staff, the professional teaching staff, to develop educational videos. So I took advantage of it, and it was also very interesting. At the time, I was teaching astronomy at the university level, so you can imagine what that was like. Very interesting, where of course I was required to teach from a textbook. But that year, for some reason, and this was like the early 1990s, the textbook companies, all, and there were many of them, all decided to upgrade their astronomy textbooks. And these, when they come out with a textbook, some companies will concentrate on higher level, medium level, and these are like there's some textbooks that are designed for, say, physics majors and astronomy majors, people that are going to go on to be astrophysicists. Then there's some that are kind of medium grade for the person who's probably got a good mathematics background, but it's not going to be using astronomy professionally in the future. And then there's the average Joe on the street astronomy course. And that is designed as kind of a gee whiz, covers all the topics. So anyway, all of these companies decided to upgrade all of their books, their textbooks, in the same year. So I had these textbook salesmen coming into my office trying to get me to buy their textbook. And of course, I was teaching the astronomy for the average guy on the street kind of astronomy. And of course, there were people in there that would have gone on to more advanced courses, maybe professionally. But anyway, that was the level I was teaching. But anyway, I had access to all these textbooks, so I thought to myself, I'm gonna order a teacher's manual copy, and along with it comes the teaching manual. And so it's another thick, just like a big traditional textbook, but accompanying, and that is the teacher's guide, which would accompany, because most people teaching astronomy did not have my background. They would have had maybe physics background, but they were not necessarily astronomy, maybe aficionados. And they would have been teaching these courses. So anyway, there was this accompanying text, teacher's manual, teacher's guide, so to speak. So anyway, I got those too. I ended up with 21 textbooks. And so anyway, I thought to myself, and then I got this grant money from the university system to produce a video, an educational video, and I thought, a good opportunity. And by that point, I had one of my classes had 90 students in it, and it was a big lecture hall, and then I had like 35, I think, had a couple sessions, so I had over 100 students total. So what I did was had a I did a study where these groups of students, each student had to do a like a paper as part of the class. So they I put them in little groups, and each group would take a topic like Venus or stars or galaxies or whatever, astronomical topics, and they were to go through all of the textbooks and see what the textbook said, see if they corroborated or whatever. And what we discovered is that the editors of one textbook were authors of another. And so this was kind of like a clubhouse of these authors making sure that all of these textbooks were right when these textbook companies released the information. And so anyway, I did this video. You can find that video on the same set of CDs at CD, I'm sorry, DVD number 1 and 2 of my that's called the Important Historical, Historically Important Videos of Me. And it goes from this early one where I'm lecturing at Los Alamos all the way up to where I'm much older, giving like 2003, 2004 at the UFO Congress, where I was talking about the Planet X, and then Electric Highways to the Stars was another one of those talks. Anyway, okay, enough of that. But the talk that I gave at Los Alamos was not, unfortunately, not videoed, because it was very interesting, not only to look at me talking, but to get the crowd reaction. Because now I'm up in front of this room with 50 of the world's top plasma physicists, lecturing them on my stuff and educating them, which this is stuff that some of them had never seen in the depth that I gave it. It was a 4-hour lecture, and when it was over, I looked out, and these guys were slumped down in their chair. They were staring at me like that was, it was quite the scene from my point of view, to stare out into a room of 50 of the world's top plasma physicists and just got a royal education from somebody. And I was much younger than them. I was young, and most of the people there, by the time that you get an appointment to Los Alamos, you're probably pretty well along in your career. It's not something that everybody gets just right out of the chute. There were some young people there, but not many. Anyway, and like I said, that morning at I went there like 8 in the morning. And so they had me set up with the high energy bomb group, where I went into meetings, and they were doing calculations on the board, calculating the death, the amount of deaths, literally, based on megatonnage of bombs that were released at different altitudes above a target. That's what they were doing. And so anyway, it was statistical. It involved mathematics and other aspects of nuclear radiation, etc. Okay, so any rate, the afternoon then I gave my talk. But what I want to do here is to give you some kind of a feel for Los Alamos itself. Okay, well, I'll jump back to this topic in a minute, because there's a couple other things I want to talk about, a couple other topics here that are relevant. You know that I follow the hydrogen world, because actually I'm involved in it myself, using the Wing generator, and that's the future of hydrogen, the future of energy. But interestingly enough, in Australia, you see these projects failing, and you go, wow, here's a project that they were going to put a hydrogen generation plant amongst a wind, three-blade wind turbine installation, but this installation was way out in the boondocks. And so anyway, they ultimately, it was only 10 megawatts, so it really was not a big system. I was surprised at the size of this. It's really, 10 megawatts is pretty small for a wind energy system. But anyway, this installation was far away from everything. And then they had planned to compress the hydrogen and move it off to a distribution point where they were using hydrogen for various uses. But the amount of hydrogen they were going to produce, they were talking in terms of tons per year. But in terms of real production of hydrogen, it was a mini, mini, little teeny production facility. And so and of course in Australia, part of the problem was that they would hook these wind installations into the grid, and they were having all kinds of problem because all of a sudden it'd be windy, and it would throw a surge onto the grid, and then all of a sudden the wind would die down, and they wouldn't have any energy. So these over abundance of electricity and then dearth of electricity caused problems with the grid, and so they were trying to find another use for this. But anyway, ultimately this program failed because they had to transport the hydrogen from this location to another locale, which was very far away. So it was like, I remember when I was a kid, there was a comedian, and he was talking about the date salesman or the date transporter who had a camel train. And he would go to the Far East, he would get his dates, he would put them on the camel, but the only thing he had to eat were the dates. And so by the time he got back to the country where he was going to sell the dates, he didn't have any dates left. So it was kind of like the same thing. I mean, just classic poor planning. Whoever planned this thing, and I know what happened. Somebody sold a pig with lipstick to some group of politicians or people that didn't know. Okay, we'll give you this money. They had no idea what they were doing. And ultimately, once they got into the project and started building and realizing, hey, we're going to spend all of our energy transporting this hydrogen way away to this other location. So anyway, it's just something that it gives a black eye to the industry that is fledgling. It's starting up. It's going to be the future. But then you have these idiots who, just don't know how to plan. They don't know how to plan from A to Z. In other words, you have to, this is something I have done in the study of hydrogen and in alternative fuels and energy, etc., is you have to add in all the components. And that's why three-blade wind turbines and solar are failing, because nobody ever added up all the equations. They put one out in the field, they got a little electricity, they jumped up and down, they ran and got some government money, and everybody's happy until they find out that, well, this stuff don't work. And now they got all the investment in it. And last week I was giving some grief to the national agencies, the government agencies that deal with wind energy, the national wind energy, like research institutes. And these people just don't know what they're doing, because three-blade wind turbines don't work. Any moron could see it. Three blades with the wind blowing right through it, hey, they don't work. It's very simple. And they talk about the Betz limit. These people are morons. They don't understand what the Betz limit is. The Betz limit is for non-compressible fluids in a hydrodynamic situation. And it doesn't apply to three-blade wind turbines, but they do it incorrectly, have been for years. And just morons, that's all I can say. And I've talked to these people, and they're in la-la land. Okay, enough of that. A quick mention, last week I talked about also the human footprints in New Mexico, and I've looked into this a little more, and this is really astoundingly good science. They've been working on this for a number of years, and what they've discovered was the human footprints are in concert with what they call the megafauna. So the woolly mammoths, the mastodons, the saber-toothed tigers, the giant sloth, all of those pre-Holocene period animals that went extinct all at the same time, and of course that was due to a large passing comet. And the dating, I'm not going to put dating on that because there's a lot of speculation, but the point is that as much as 20,000 years ago, man in his current form, just like you and me, not Neanderthal, not little leaky little people running around Africa. No, we're talking man, woman, just like you and me, walking around, coexisting with those animals. And so this is major league discovery, and I'm sure for a long time to come there will be people still teaching the baloney that man crossed the Bering Strait, a couple thousand years ago and populated the Western Hemisphere or something, you know. Anyway, enough of that, but very good research and being done within the guidelines of standard science. So very interesting. But the astronomy community dealing with comets and all kinds of other topics still out in La La Land. Okay, so back to the just one other topic quick here. The MR5 whole house water filter, just want to remind you, this is the flagship product of JMC water filters. I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to chew up a lot of time on the air. I'm just going to tell you, go to the webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com, or go directly to the sales page, is mymr5.com. That's MYMR5, the number 5, dot com, 5 letters, mymr5.com. And here's what happened. We had a sale. It was an amazing sale, and if you missed it, you missed it. But the pricing previously was $2,350 for the MR5, the UV filter, and the extra set of filter elements, what we call the best deal. And then some people buy additional filter packs, etc. But at any rate, the normal price was $2,350. We dropped the price to because of moving the warehouse and the moving the warehouse sale to reduce stock, etc. Anyway, that ended. That ended last Sunday night, and or I'm sorry, like 2 weeks ago actually. And so but the prices went back up. But because I realized in talking to people and getting response, customer response, that people are rather hurting out there. So anyway, the prices are not going up back up to 100% of the retail price. So anyway, go to the webpage, just check out the information. There's a frequently asked questions, a lot of information there. Once again, mymr5.com. Okay, back to Los Alamos. Now, what I want to do is give you a feel for what it would be like if you were working there, what it would have been like in World War II if you were on the bomb team. And you have a lot of the great people there. And then also a little bit that's come out since about personal conflicts in the group. For example, I saw some videos, and one of these people I know personally, there were two people that were commenting on the choice of Oppenheimer as the head of the bomb group, the Los Alamos Manhattan Project, it was called. And Beda had rave reviews for Oppenheimer. He said he was the perfect man for the job, that he was very quick to learn, and he was a good organizer, and he moved the project along. Then you have Freeman Dyson also working on the project in his early years, and he said that, of course, he said that he thought that Oppenheimer was a terrible leader, that he didn't understand things. He was off in Washington 2/3 of the time. He wasn't there. And so I don't know. I mean, I really don't know. I respect Hans Bethe's opinion. But whenever you have something like this going on, you're going to find, especially you have people with, I would say, pretty big egos. The people who are top physicists back then, as well as now, these people all have relatively big egos. And to put them all in one spot and expect them to work together and produce a product, but in the end, they produced on schedule a product. And so, anyway, this involved a national effort. As I mentioned before, they were gathering uranium from around the country and then purifying it down by St. Louis. There was a purification plant, and then also up by in Oregon, there was another one. But anyway, and a lot of people got sick. And this is one of the really devastating parts of the Manhattan Project, is the number of people that got ill from handling the uranium, because it wasn't well understood at the time the amount of damage that would happen from basically the radiation. So a lot of people got sick. It got in the water supply. There were a lot of people that had health effects and still do around the St. Louis area. I know I've talked to people who have farms there. They can't raise animals because it's in the water, it's in the grass, it's in the, you know, the, if they try and grow something for animals. And even the dogs die, you know, regularly. They cannot keep animals on their farms. But the whole issue is that they had to concentrate the uranium into a form, what you call bomb grade. In other words, it's pure uranium. It's a solid piece of material that's uranium. So concentrating that was one of the big efforts of the entire bomb program. But ultimately, when they built two bombs, the two that were eventually dropped on Japan, they only had enough uranium to make those two. So they did have a little bit, and they had enough to test. And by, like I said last week, the two designs of the bombs they dropped on Japan were different. They were very different, based on very different theoretical structures. And so one of them, they had what they call the Trinity bomb test, and they had to test the design to see if it actually worked. They ended up with two designs, and the second design they never tested. They didn't have enough uranium, so the first time it was ever released was actually when it dropped on Nagasaki. And so the end result was that both of the bombs worked and gave Japan the impression that we had lots of these. If they would have only dropped one and then waited and waited and waited and nothing else happened, they'd go, okay, they only had one. But everybody in the world knew. Everybody, you know, all of the warring parties in World War II, the big players, the Japans, Russia, Germany, the United States, Great Britain, and, the European countries involved also in the war, were very much aware of the development of the bomb, and it was critical for the only place that could develop it was the United States, that had the resources on the Ally side of the coin. And of course, Germany and Russia were both working on that. The Russian scientists were hot on the trail also. And there were scientists from basically all over the world who had contributed pieces of this, like the Curies. There were Italian scientists who were working on it. So this was a major effort, but the reality is, who had the resources to put together the entire package, from the gathering of the uranium, from the cleansing of the uranium, from putting the scientists together that had the resources to build all the facilities and get them into one spot, and then have the organizational know-how plus the physicists who had the theoretical work, and putting all this together into a single package. And so it really turns out that the only places that could have possibly done this were the United States, and Germany was very advanced. Everybody was surprised, I'll put it this way, from the physics world, everybody was surprised that the United States actually beat Germany. But Germany was on the verge of it. They may have been like days away also, but the German situation was different because they fell because of the Normandy invasion. Their World War II effort ended because of the land war, because of the air war that was going on. So they never had a chance to finish putting the bomb together, but Russia did. And then at the end, now here's one of the critical key positions too, and this continues to this day, and I'll talk about my own situation. how the information on making the bomb was moved from the United States to Russia. And, you know, because there's a lot of critical components. The Russians were probably quite a ways away from actually producing a workable bomb. But once you get the formula, it's like baking a cake. Once you get the formula, okay, then everybody knows how to do it. It's just a matter of making it better, making it more efficient, making it bigger. And then the Russians started on a program post-World War II of making really big bombs. They weren't as efficient, but they were big. So they had the megatonnage big bombs going into, and this is what I was talking about when I was a young kid. And they were starting to put together bombs that would be delivered by jet airplanes. The United States had the B-52 bombers, and those fleets of airplanes being built back in the early days of the Cold War, still in use today, being refitted with new engines, and that's the only big change that those planes have had, still considered to be very, very good weapons in terms of flying through radar, getting to their targets, and Russia concentrating on bombs. And then I remember there was the time when the MIRVs, the multiple reentry directed warheads, there was an outlaw on them because in preventing the nuclearization of outer space, those two things were critical, because the idea being that if a country like Russia or the United States could put nuclear weapons into orbit with multiple reentry vehicles, MIRVs as they were called, they could rain down within minutes. They could just rain down on cities, killing off all the population. And then, of course, then along came something called the neutron bomb, which would not explode and destroy all the buildings like the plutonium bombs, but they were designed to kill the people. In other words, you drop a neutron bomb on a city, it would kill all the people and leave the buildings intact. So you could just drive in and take over, and just like all of a sudden, you know, clean out the dead people and you were good to go. So that was outlawed. You know, these are all the things that came much later as things developed. But the insanity continues. For a while now, you have to understand the international uranium industry continues today, and much of it is controlled by let's put it, nefarious dealings. The whole issue up in Oregon, remember the farmers? They were burning them out. They were going up there burning these people out. What happened is, this is the real story, which never came out on the news. Remember Lavoie Finicum, the guy that was shot? He was trying to get out of Oregon into another county for safe haven. And these people were not really understanding why the federal government was coming in and burning down their houses and barns and killing all their animals to get them off of there. The real reason was because the Uranium One, which was a Hillary Clinton deal with Russia, what they were doing was they were moving the uranium through out of Canada to Russia, to Iran, to support the Iran nuclear program, and making money by doing this. So what they were trying to, and this is the reason, because, and I just mentioned this, that in the World War II development of the bomb, they were cleaning the uranium and spreading it on the fields. Well, those farmers' ranches were on the fields where they spread the uranium. And so they wanted these people off of there so they could go out and scrape up the surface and reclaim that uranium. Anyway, there's the nuclear industry, the nuclear world is one of the most corrupt, evil pieces of crap that ever crawled out from under a rock on planet Earth. I could go on and on about that. But anyway, that's not the point of this story. I just wanted to give you somewhat of a flavor of what grew out of the Los Alamos years. What grew out of Los Alamos was the Cold War. Let's just put it that way. And the scientists who worked there were doing a job. They were doing a job that arguably would have been necessary if the United States and Britain and other allies' invasion of Germany would not have been successful. And there were times when it looked like the invasion of Germany was going to fail. For many reasons, most historians would agree with that, due to flukes and just the way it turned out. Who can say why or give all the reasons? But the invasion of Normandy was successful, so Germany never had time for its scientists to develop. But what happened to those scientists, the Wernher von Brauns and the rocket scientists, realized that when the other shoe was falling, they realized that Berlin would fall, that the war was going to be over, and they were in danger because they held the knowledge developed in Germany. They were in danger of being killed by their own hierarchy. So they packed up all of their notes on rocketry, etc., in cars. And they went to the border and crossed and got the information, which eventually was part of Operation Paperclip, bringing those scientists into the United States. At the end of World War II, the scientists were divided up. Some went to Russia, some went to the United States. And it arguably, they say that the United States got the better end of that deal. But kind of like Europe was divided up, the scientists were divided up. And so eventually, of course, Wernher von Braun was the one who spearheaded the U.S. rocket moon program. And anyway, that's a whole nother story. But in that same group of scientists were people who were brought to Los Alamos as literally permanent residents, as scientists. And there were still remnants of them there when I was there. The morning before my talk, I went into a group. It was the high energy bomb group, and there were people there. There were elderly men, and they were probably, I would say, in their 70s or more at that point. And they were dressed in literally World War II, the kind of clothes you would see in a black and white movie of World War II. With the wide pants, the wool pants, you know, and the little thin tie and the pleated shirts, a very thick accent when they talked, but clearly had been there since World War II. They were still working there. Other people I met that were at Los Alamos, well, Hans Bethe, when I was at Cornell, 1979 to 1981, I got to know Hans Bethe, who was on the Manhattan Project. And my conversations with him were dealing with solar physics. He had won the Nobel Prize for understanding what they call the chemical chains, the building chains. And then, of course, they weren't chemical, they were nuclear. But the building chains of the atomic structures as they build up in stars. But he knew that there were some problems with it. Some of the physics didn't work out, and that's why we had some very interesting conversations, because I had said no, and I could prove to him that the solar fusion was up in the atmosphere. And this resolved a lot of the issues dealing with the core fusion model, which was, of course, in vogue at the time. And it was Hans Bethe that encouraged me, and because I had published papers in the astrophysics journals, but I was being kind of like harassed, let's put it that way, by Carl Sagan and the boys at Cornell, trying to block me from publishing my work. It was Hans Bethe that redirected me to the European journals and to the Netherlands, where my papers eventually were published. And so anyway, that was a big help because, and then of course, even those locations got a lot of heat from the Cornell University staff saying if they continue to publish my work, they would boycott them. And of course, they folded in favor of the big boys, not me. But they did publish Zdeněk Koupal and did publish my work enough to get it recognized. But it, like I say, it was Hans Bethe that directed me to those locations and people who were accepting of what I was doing. And I had about 10 papers in line that were all ready to be published, and they got kind of slam dunked. And being blackballed to this day from... But what's interesting is as my career developed after I left Cornell, I was very much involved in what I call Tier 1 science with the electromagnetic propulsion systems and giving talks at closed meetings, the invitation to Los Alamos. So I was very much involved in Tier 1 science and ongoing. And that continued those collaborations into the future, including the work that I did with the Russian scientists. I would certainly consider them Tier 1 scientists. But I want to get back to my talk at Los Alamos. And like I say, this is kind of like the early to mid-1980s when this is going on. But here's a rather comical note. As I said, the venue had to change from this smaller kind of classroom where they had the cameras set up to this bigger, more like an auditorium type of location because of the number of people that showed up for my talk. And it was clearly stated the title of my talk was James McCanney, and they all knew who I was, the plasma discharge comet model. So one of the scientists walks into the room and he goes, "Oh, okay, is this where the snowball fight is?" And everybody laughed. So it was like a comic relief because it was kind of like, you know, but these guys, one thing good about physicists, they have a sense of humor, and a lot of times physics jokes, not many people would laugh at, but that's kind of like remember the show, the long-term TV show, The Big Bang Theory? A lot of physics-related humor, and the public loved it. But anyway, I just wanted to mention that, yeah, the guy walks into the room and he goes, "Is this where the snowball fight is?" You know, and everybody laughed. And it really kind of set the tone for everybody knew, it really was very clear that everybody knew what was going on there, what this talk was about. Okay, so at any rate, I just want to mention also that after my talk was over, I left Los Alamos and went back to the motel where I was staying. And like I said, my girlfriend came with me. So she had gone out that day and gone shopping and came back. And she had a bottle of champagne and rented the movie Dr. Strangelove. And so if you've never seen Dr. Strangelove, it's the Dr. Strangelove. And the subtitle was How I Learned to Love the Bomb. But anyway, it was about, very interesting, after being at Los Alamos to sit down and watch that movie, putting things somewhat into perspective. But if you've never seen that movie, go see it, and then imagine that that's what I did after leaving there. And then, into the future from that meeting, I was in communication with the people at Goddard, and not so much JPL, but Goddard and Los Alamos, because JPL was more, I would call them Tier 2 scientists, the hardcore military scientists. Not everybody at Goddard was Tier 1. There was a mixture there, and there was a lot of personality conflicts that I had eventually with people at Goddard. They had kind of bigger egos than they should have had, let me just put it that way. But like I say, the people at Los Alamos, that's purely Tier 1, strictly military science, and they were no BS people. They wanted the straight story. They wanted to know how it worked, and that's all. You would never see their name in publications or on the news media or anything. These were people that are tucked away, and they are completely out of the limelight, you might say. Okay, now I'm going to switch gears a little bit here to talk about the Cold War. And the merchants of death who work the arms dealers, basically. And I met them. I met not all of them, but I met some enough to know what's going on. And the reason I got to know them was through venture capital groups working out of Los Angeles when I was there in the early 1980s. Marketing my electromagnetic propulsion systems. And I talked about this before, where I developed electromagnetic propulsion systems for moving spacecraft and guiding spacecraft and other types of maneuvers like docking mechanisms for spacecraft using magnetic fields. And so I had a whole series of these inventions, and I was marketing these. I got to through the vetting process with the physicists, who were all very good Tier 1 physicists. And then it got into the funding stages. And so this was interesting because I was very well, the people who knew me in the science world knew that I was a conscientious objector to the Vietnam War. I mean, that was literally my draft status was CO. Conscientious objector, and I earned that status by being an objector to the Vietnam War and going before my draft board and being grilled and grueled to that's another story. That's a whole litany unto itself, but anyway, the attitude amongst the arms dealers that all arms or all scientific inventions had to be used and made into some kind of an arm, armament. And so I was in some closed meeting with the funding people, and I told them, I said, I don't want my magnetic propulsion systems being used to deliver nuclear warheads or for armament. And of course, that's exactly what they wanted to do. But in my time there, in dealing with these people, which got to be fairly extensive and fairly high-level meetings, I realized that they were taking technology that was developed by engineers that I knew and moving it off to Russia. And I knew specific examples. For example, features on military aircraft, jet aircraft, for example, and I'm not going to go into details here, but at the time it was the F-series jets, fighter jets of the U.S., that mainly used by the U.S. Navy, and things that development that would allow the plane to flip sideways while it was in mid-flight and shoot its ordnance, and then flip back to flying straight again. And so anyway, these were developments that were then tested in wind tunnels, etc. But anyway, I considered this to be what I would consider extreme top secret. Extreme top secret in the design of airframes and aircraft. The next year, the Russians had incorporated that into one of their MiG fighter models in the Paris Air Show. And so I'm going, wait a minute. What's going on here? And then I started picking apart the story also. And this is apart from the scientists that work on these projects, the engineers, etc. And this is the key to the Cold War. Now, the Cold War was a banker continuation of World War II. And it was to keep the arms dealers well groomed, well funded throughout all this time. And of course, that's what's going on right now with Ukraine, where they come out and say, okay, the United States has used up all of its capital equipment and we have to make more. And even though it was at record stockpiles prior to this current Democratic administration being in office, but unless you have wars, you're not shooting up ammunition. If you're not shooting up ammunition and wearing out machinery, then there's no business. Just having something available, and that happened under Obama, where they completely used up the military. And it was, when Trump came in, he built up the military and said, okay, now we have it in reserve. Well, that doesn't make money. That's okay for a couple of years. But then you need a good war to burn up all of the, expend all of the equipment and all the new developed equipment so that they can build more. And so the key, the point of all of this is that the key to the Cold War, which is still going on, if you haven't noticed, the key to the Cold War is that both sides have equal equipment capability. And so what I realized is that to maintain the Cold War, including nuclear capability, both sides had to have relatively equal capability. It's just as simple as that. The other half of this equation is the arms dealers who are there for a profit. They don't care about anything or anybody. All they care about is selling arms. And so when a new technology breaks, for example, somebody that's on the inside track in a venture capital group, it's a race to Russia with that technology, because the first guy there gets to sell it, the second guy there doesn't. So it's literally a race to see who gets to Russia first and their contacts in Russia to sell the design, the implementation, the engineering advancements, etc. And that's the whole idea, is that this is part of the banker scheme to maintain the Cold War. And this is what they did. As a good example, this has happened many times throughout history. For example, one of the best examples is in Russia, the Russian Revolution, early 1900s, the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks. The Mensheviks were called the Whites, and the Bolsheviks were called the Reds. And that's why you call the Russians the Reds, because the Bolsheviks won the revolution. But really, what happened is that the European bankers were funding both sides of the Russian Revolution, the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks. And at a certain point, what they were really doing is that was the smokescreen and the implementation of communism, which is going on in the United States right now, where they pit one group against another. In Russia, it was the proletariat. They got the proletariat all riled up, thinking that it was those darn rich people in Russia that were causing all their problems. And so that's where the Russian Revolution came from, the proletariat versus the bourgeois, the reigning monarch, the czar, etc. And so the fermenting the Russian Revolution. And of course, that's going on in the United States, where there's division against every group, against every other group. That's the Communist Manifesto. That's the way you tear down a country. It's going on in the United States right now. But back to Russia Revolution, the European bankers were funding both sides, and eventually they pulled funding from the Mensheviks. They couldn't get arms, they couldn't get bullets, and of course they lost. They built up arms and funding for the Bolsheviks, and of course they won. And so by the time the smoke cleared, the European bankers had their banking system well in place and full control of the country. And that continued up until very recent times. But anyway, the whole point is, back to the issue of the bomb, it was very important for the European bankers to maintain equal technology. And if you live through this, like I did, every day on the news, Russia has more nuclear arms than we do. They have bigger ones than we do. They have more capability. Remember, they put Sputnik into space before we did. We needed the space race. Everything was pitted against the Russians, us against them, and they were our foe. And really, when I worked with Russian scientists myself. They're just regular people, the people that live in Russia. They don't hate Americans any more than, it's all propaganda. But it's all propaganda by the owned news media, the propaganda news media in both countries that fermented. And the people bought it hook, line, and sinker for 50 years. For 50 years, the Cold War lasted. And Russia and the United States never, literally between the two of them, never fired a shot, never dropped a bomb. They had skirmishes in other little places that were like Vietnam or Cambodia or Laos or whatever, but never between the two countries, Russia and the United States. And that was the whole point, is to keep those two countries pitted against each other because, and this is why every president who had half a brain knew that they could not go against the banking community, because if they did, they would be swiped out of office immediately. And that's what happened with John Kennedy, who thought he was going to be president and make decisions. Another person who fell to that false mentality was somebody, Hillary Clinton. She was supposed to be president in place of Obama. That was her turn to be president. And she thought she was going to be president and be queen of the world, rule everything. And one day, the Rockefellers in New York, a part of the Rothschild World Empire, banking empire, pulled the rug out from under her, pulled all her funding, and sent her back. She had to be in Congress. She then was Secretary of the State under Obama, who she hated, and just was the most humiliating experience for her. But she had to understand that she was not the queen. She was a worker bee, and she had to do what she was told. And she learned that and finally got the run for president in 2016. But that's another example of how the bankers control people, especially at the presidential level. So at any rate, but this has to do with the Cold War, because the Cold War is maintained because the presidents are not presidents. The Congress is not what it's supposed to be. And the people who really are running everything are people that you never see. And the real hierarchy goes up to the European bankers. And the people who make the money off of this are the warlords, the military-industrial complex families who make unbelievable amounts of money because of this system. And nobody ever knows their names, don't know who they are. I got to see the edge of this. I got to see the edge of it. And I talk about this in my book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, where I'm dealing with venture capital groups in Los Angeles who are the front agencies for these families who invest in technology. And I was there in the office, and I would notice these young guys in there, I mean, just out of college age, picking up the phone, telling congressmen to vote for a certain thing, and moving millions of dollars in new little companies would start up every day. And I thought, man, where did these guys go to college? How did they get these jobs? And then I realized they didn't get jobs. These are families. These are the kids of families who are involved in the military arms trade. And they grew up in it, and they're going to continue it, because it's what they do. It's what the families do. And these were international in scope. They weren't just, these were international. And so you see that. And by the way, the whole Hunter Biden laptop thing is just a giant smokescreen. That's what I've said before. It's nothing but a smokescreen, whether you look at, supposedly hard-hitting Fox News, which isn't hard-hitting news at all. It's just repeating the same thing over and over. But it's just a smokescreen. And it's the typical CIA-controlled news media where they create both sides of the story, and it looks like there's this big feud going on, but there isn't. And all it is a smokescreen so that the regular business as usual can keep going on in the background. Simple as that. Okay, so now one other aspect of being in my position here, having worked and done a lot of the things that I've done, made discoveries that are essential to science, there's a two-edged sword as far as who I am and who I am in the science world. First of all, I continue to make discoveries, and the people that know about me know that I have a lot more work to be published here, especially with, for example, the prime number work and other discoveries relative to science. So, and these are things that nobody else had a clue about. I'm one of those people that have put the key in the lock and turned it, and have a very good grasp of, say, plasma physics and the workings of comets or solar physics, things like that. But then on the other hand, I'm independent, and they hate that. Nobody wants an independent scientist. As a scientist, you're supposed to be owned. You're supposed to be working for the government in some capacity, whether it's a private corporation that gets their money from federal funding, in a think tank, in a laboratory or something like that, where you're working on a project that's government condoned. I don't do that. I never have. So I'm a person that they don't like, because I also have a very clear picture of what's going on in the world. And you're not going to hear this on Fox News. You're not going to hear this in the National Geographic or on the Discovery Channel or the History Channel. You're not going to see this in Scientific American or Science Magazine or Nature Magazine. You're not going to see this kind of perspective from anybody. There's not a single scientist working today on a high level that can go up to a microphone and make a public statement. It simply cannot happen. Anything that is released by scientists today is very controlled. So anyway, I'm about out of time here, but anyway, I'm glad I got these lectures in about Los Alamos, the Cold War, those topics. Just remind you, go to my webpage. Remember, I don't have sponsors. I don't have people throwing money in my back door from the government or agencies. The money that I get is from your purchases of my extremely good water filter equipment, etc. So, and the books, of course, on my webpage. So go to the webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com, or go directly to the MR5 sales page, mymr5.com. I'm out of time. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.